You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again David McElvaney of the McElvaney Financial Companies. David is the president of that of the McElvaney Financial Companies, which includes Wealth Management and ICA. It's a precious metals brokerage firm. And before taking over the business from his father, who founded the McElvaney Companies, David had a very impressive academic background and achieved honors as a top salesman in Southwestern Company and gained an extensive business expertise with Morgan Stanley in California. But David's life and goals are intentionally about a whole lot more than grabbing all the financial wealth he can get. Certainly, he and his father before him have had a considerable amount of financial success, but David understands that without a godly spiritual dimension, without a spirit of forgiveness and redemption, which allows us to live joyous and productive lives, we can be downright unhappy, and we can cause untold harm to others, no matter how much wealth we have. I'd like to just read a thought that David has put out in a book that he wrote called The Intentional Legacy, and I quote David because I think this is so important beyond the financial stuff we talk about all the time on this show. And David said in the book, and I quote, "Our lives are not our own. Every choice we make will shape the destiny of children yet to be born. Every act of love or hatred, redemption or savagery, thoughtfulness or selfishness, births a future for ourselves and others. We live lives permeated by legacy, the legacy given to us and the legacy we cultivate every waking moment of the day. We are the custodians of a general story. Ours is but one chapter, positioned somewhere in the index of a book of indiscernible length. The narrative begins long before we were born. It continues further into the future than we might imagine. We may not do with our lives whatever we choose. There is a higher call. We are the trustees, the caretakers of our great-grandchildren's future. Our very existence is a gift given by God to be dedicated to His service. That service finds an immediate and practical expression in the context of the life and labor of the family. Our greatest aspirations and highest ideals are reflected in the life we live with our children. It is not enough that our children succeed. We want them also building upon our victories and transcending our defeats. It is our children, not our jobs, which are the most important work of our lives." End of quote. So welcome, David, and thank you so much for joining me again today on Turning Hard Times into Good Times. And I want to thank you so much for the book that you've written, which I think is really an inspiration to me, and I know an awful lot of other people as well. So I just want to thank you so much for coming on the show again today, and I just wanted to share that part of your being with our listeners, because I think it's so important that people keep that in mind, what is really important in life. So thanks again for being with us.
Thank you, Jay, for that warm welcome back.
Yeah, it's always good to have you with me. I want to get your views on the markets in a moment or two from now, but I would like to ask you, how can we apply the ideas of forgiveness and redemption that you talk about in your book in our country when organizations like Black Lives Matter and Antifa are burning down buildings and causing untold monetary and psychological harm to citizens in various cities around the U.S., and when we white folks are sometimes called racist simply because of the color of our skin? It seems kind of hard. I know that we're supposed to be forgiving people, but it's kind of difficult. So I'm just wondering if you can give us some guidance how we can do that.
Jay, that's a big question, and I don't know that I'm fully qualified to answer it. So my opinion is straightforward. There's the history, which is behind us, the present, which we're encountering, and obviously a lot of frustration and a desire for justice. Justice is important. Justice is very important. And certainly a champion for that. But a part of justice is remembering the past rightly. You can have history as it's changed through time. Even if we remember our own lives, there's things that I might remember at age 10, 11, or 12, and the way I remember them isn't necessarily exactly the way they happened. So there's a challenge to get at history so that we are dealing with facts and we are dealing with an acknowledgement of wrongs where wrongs have been done, and it's all right for there to be accountability. I don't know exactly how that works cross-generationally in terms of, you know, something that might have happened 100 years ago, and I'm as accidentally in this story where I am as someone else is. But I certainly want to understand the sense of anxiety and suffering, if it is that, that someone else experiences. I don't know that I'll necessarily take ownership of things that don't rightly belong on my shoulders. Mm-hmm. But it is important where there's things that we have done or contributed to that we take responsibility for those actions. I think that's perhaps where my frustration might echo yours. I'm not sure if we can take responsibility for things that go that sort of precede us 100 years or something. Mm-hmm. Like that. So I'm open to the conversation, mm-hmm. and I want to be sensitive to what may be a very real struggle for someone else, and may seem minimized from my standpoint only because of how I was raised and where I was raised and and whatnot.
Yeah, I agree, and I think it's really good to be introspective, to look inside our own hearts and souls sometimes to try to find out, because it's very easy, not having lived in someone else's shoes, not to see what they see and how they see it. So the importance of being able to live civilly and be able to discuss with people what our beliefs are, and this is one of the things that's broken down so much now, is this ability to discuss civilly with one another and to treat each other with respect. I try to see it as that everybody has been created by God and they're just as worthy as I am. So I think if we can start from that point of view, then it's helpful anyway. So anyway, go ahead.
A few weeks ago, I had a philosopher, professor of philosophy on my weekly commentary, and we were talking about the issue of fake news, and we were talking about the issue of partisanship, and we were talking about the need for epistemic humility, where we have to recognize there's some things we know, and there's a lot of things that we don't. And yet there's often claims made to know a lot more than we do. Mm-hmm. And you know, so you see the partisanship, the nastiness, the lack of civility in public discourse, and I think a part of it does deal with this issue of epistemic humility or lack thereof. Mm-hmm. And if we can engage people with a little bit more epistemic humility, a willingness to listen, and that's coming from both sides,
yeah,
a healthy conversation, I think, can be had. It's harder to have right now because people are fairly convinced they have the whole truth and nothing but the truth, and everyone else is 100% wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, if you start with that, then you're not going to get very far. That's for sure. I did listen to part of that episode, by the way, David. And tell our listeners how they can, where can they go to get, because you have a weekly commentary that you do, and it's usually it's at least 30 minutes long, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, 30 minutes to an hour at the most. Typically 30 to 45 minutes. Weeklycommentary.com is the easiest. Mm-hmm. Weeklycommentary.com or McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. Either one will get you there.
I've titled today's show Managing Risks in an Increasingly Chaotic World, and certainly part of what is uncertain right now has to do with politics, and specifically in the United States, at least, with regard to who controls the Senate. Certainly there have been, on the blue side of the aisle, a desire to sort of do away with a lot of the institutions that some of us have believed are important in terms of keeping government from becoming way too powerful. At least those were the views of our founding fathers. Do you have a sense of which way this might go? And either way, could you perhaps comment on what it might mean in terms of our future, specifically, I guess, with respect to economics, the economic picture, how that might differ depending on which way the Senate tilts?
Yeah, I mean, stepping back from the current mass in Washington, what we have seen over any time slice, 25 years, 50 years, 100 years or more, is that crisis represents a period of time where the size and scale of government ratchets higher. And when mm-hmm. crisis recedes, the governmental footprint does not. So
that's right.
And it's not an issue of right versus left, blue versus red. The reality is the role, the scope and scale of government tends to increase dramatically, the budget with it, of course, and then it does not scale back. So mm-hmm. we have that yet again. We've got a health crisis, and, you know, certainly I'm encouraged to see death rates on the decline, even though we have case rates on the rise, and maybe with vaccines, this is something that's hopeful. Certainly, the stock market thinks that it's worth mm-hmm. being hopeful for. But this is what we face in 2021: an increased scope and regimen for government, and that would have been the case either way. If Trump had won, it still would have been the case. Mm-hmm. We would have been just a little less heartburn, perhaps, amongst conservatives, and you know, obviously more heartburn on the other side of the aisle.
On the other side, yeah. Mm-hmm. But it, with respect to monetary and fiscal policy, what are your thoughts? I mean, would you see more fiscal policy, more probably, and less monetary, more reliance on fiscal if the Democrats control the Senate?
That'll be the key. So we get through the Georgia runoff, and we'll have a little bit more clarity on that. It would be a tough. The odds don't favor both seats going to the Democrats. So, and I think that may be what the markets are enthusiastic about too. Is they see kind of the hands tied in terms of real regulation, because I think there's some things that could absolutely strangle the markets. Mm-hmm. If you had the ability to increase taxes or whatnot. So, you know, the Senate, I think that's one of the real keys. Monetary policy is shown to be fairly ineffective, and fiscal policy, even with this week's announcements of a stimulus package, which I presume will be passed in large measure before the end of the year, because you've got the hot potato of over 10 million people losing all benefits, you know, which will cause a major hemorrhaging within the real estate markets, you know, as we go into January. And that's really not the tone that I think anyone wants to set. So will we see more after the $908 billion? Yeah, I think we will see a lot more. And, you know, fiscal policy will just be playing catch up with monetary policy. We're not going to be tightening monetary policy anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. No, it's pretty hard to see how that could work, given the enormous amount of debt. The fact is, it seems to me that the Fed is trapped, essentially. It can't allow rates to rise. It can't allow the markets to function and allocate capital as a free market would, and so
this, if you have you know, failure of the Democrats to win both of those seats, and we've got, you know, blue White House and red Senate, you know, there's not going to be an ability to raise taxes significantly, and I think that puts a lot of pressure downward on rates, where, you know, the only way to extract value and start the redistribution process is what they call financial repression. And that's mm-hmm. just taking us down to zero. You know, you feel like you're at zero when, you know, 30-year mortgage is at 2.72%, the 10-year treasury is at 85 basis points. But even this week, we can remember that low can still go lower. And that's pretty well illustrated by Greek debt, Italian debt, you know, Spanish and Portuguese debt, you know, at or below zero, believe it or not, with countries that obviously are their credits mispriced. But that, I think, is something that we have to consider. It's very supportive to the metals prices, low negative real rates, but that is another form of value extraction. If you can't move tax policy, they'll get you. just a different way.
Yeah. You know, it's really hard to see. Then what, depending on, I mean, how are you and your team at Wealth Management planning 2021 and currently, how are you allocating, how are you suggesting to your clients they allocate their resources? And how, I mean, what's your portfolio look like? I know you've got gold in there. That's a given with the McIlvany, I think.
But we have vigorous debate. There's vigorous debate on the team.
That's
and
good.
We've had some productive meetings the last few weeks, but some hard-fought meetings too. So, you know, what we're focusing on is process, position size, sector exposure, and cash allocation as a means of managing risk. And the process is what we're involved with constantly. Position size is really determining if we have too much exposure to any one company or sector, and of course the sector exposure, we're trying to balance, particularly in our case, amongst four different areas of hard assets. And we do, as you mentioned, have as sort of a ballast exposure, a metals position. But I'd say, you know, having a healthy cash position coming into this next year, you can't be 100% cash. You can run an insane market much higher just on the basis of insane monetary policy. And I think you and I both have probably been in the category of folks that lacked an imagination for how high things like the Federal Reserve balance sheet could go. And maybe we think 10 trillion is an outside number. Maybe we discover next year that 10 on the way to 20, you know, we're just getting things started. So what are the possibilities? You know, the Bank of Japan just this week went ahead and marked to market $50 billion in gains on their equity portfolio. Yeah. And, you know, you've got folks at the Fed saying, why didn't we do that? We've been buying paper. We could actually be, you know, the equivalent of hedge fund heroes. Why didn't we buy this index or that index or this company or that company? And, you know, so I think the markets can go higher. And this is where there's debate on the team. My gut instinct is that we get to the middle of January, end of January, and we have the potential for having put in a top that remains the top for 2-3 years, in which case you could see a 30-40% decline from there. And, you know, so you have a tremendous amount of structural frailty within the financial markets, but they're juicing the system. And it's a very dangerous environment, a very dangerous environment. So where we're putting money to work, we're doing it very judiciously and pretty happy having a metals exposure and a healthy cash exposure, which today is, you know, at a minimum 30%, in some accounts as high as 42-43%, which is a reasonably high cash position for us.
42% cash.
At the outside.
It goes against Ray Dalio's ideas that cash is trash and so are bonds. And I get, you certainly would understand that. I mean, but cash for opportunities. So you're looking at the possibility of having a significant decline in the equity markets, possibly. And it certainly is good to have cash when you see opportunities come along. I know how many times I've not had the cash when I wish I had. So from that perspective, it's certainly valuable to have it.
I think you have to look at the cash balance as an expression of opportunism as well as defense, you know, where you see, you know, the opportunity to add to positions, companies that we really like, and we're not at full allocation. So we haven't stepped into the market and just backed up the truck. And given financial market frailties, we do think we're going to have the opportunity to own a lot more of what we already like. And so the circumstances are such that we think that is going to be happening in the first quarter. Yeah, we could be wrong. Timing can get stretched out. But that's one of the reasons why we are still putting money to work, too. So that cash balance, regardless of any event driven, will be reduced between now and the, you know, end of the first quarter. Mm-hmm. Just because the markets can, as they say, the markets can remain irrational longer than you can solve it.
Yeah, that's for sure. You mentioned four sectors. So you have cash, you have gold, equities, general equities. Is that the other?
The four areas within our hard asset portfolios are infrastructure, specialty real estate, global natural resources, and precious metals, particularly the precious metals miners. And so those are four areas that provide both growth and income. When we occasionally allocate to the hard asset itself, not the miners, that's done to sort of balance our cash exposure. So with sensitivity to Dalio's cash is trash, we look and say, you know, look at our whole basket of quote-unquote liquidity, where a part of that is gold bullion and a part of that is greenbacks, and one kind of balances out the risk of the other. And maintains a broad, in the, we still carry it under the broad category of liquidity.
What are your thoughts about Bitcoin?
I have a few. It is, I think, one of the most, for me, it's an obvious expression of the speculative juices that are in the financial markets today. And it's just, it's one more expression of fast money, of easy money. You know, all of a sudden gold up 20% or silver up 27%, even with this correction, that looks silly in comparison with 100, 162% gain in Bitcoin. Who would want to own anything that was only up 30 or 40%? I mean, so when I talk to folks about Bitcoin and what their purchases have been with Bitcoin, it's pretty clear to me that it's fast money, it's make a quick buck. There's not a lot of strategic thinking, but there is a lot of intellectual backfilling to justify and buttress why they own it. Well, you know, it's like 21st century gold. Well, you know, it's going to replace gold. Well, you know, and it's really not, but all those legitimate references with the ancient barbaric relic, I think still hold. The value of gold in a portfolio is legitimate. And I'm not saying Bitcoin doesn't have a place in a portfolio, but I think of it as a lunch money investment. You know, where if you can, you know, if you have 1% of a portfolio in something like that, it is in the category of a speculation. If it is going to be a currency someday, the best you can say is that today it's a very young currency. Mm-hmm. It has not matured. It is in no way a store of value or a means of exchange. You know, you still can't buy a cup of coffee with it, and maybe that changes. Right, so mm-hmm. So as it matures, maybe it becomes more interesting. But I'm also guessing, Jay, that as it matures and as it really challenges the money monopoly, what do you think the folks who have the money monopoly are going to say about that?
And
that's where I think that, you know, referencing back to Ken Rogoff when he wrote his book, The Curse of Cash, you know, he was all for moving to a digital based, you know, society, or you don't have physical cash, so you think, well, digital's got to be the thing. This is what he said about Bitcoin. What the private sector may innovate, in due time, the government regulates and appropriates.
Yeah.
So the best case scenario is Bitcoin is a success, and then it's regulated and appropriated. and it's not what you thought it was. It's the greatest expression of monetary freedom we've seen in the 21st century, I would say, other than gold, and it ends up being something of a trap. I think there'll be some irony in that as it unfolds in time.
Certainly interesting. I know, David, when we spoke to you last, you don't buy into this idea that the dollar could be in trouble as the world's reserve currency. I think you see it, at least for the foreseeable future, as the major currency globally, right?
I mean, it's a difficult question in the sense that yes, the dollar is doomed, but no, it's not going to die tomorrow. You see less interest in having it as a reserve asset. Who are the people who don't want to have it? You know, Turkey and Russia has been really interested in ditching the dollar and going to gold. Well, that's interesting, but that doesn't mean that our role as the world's reserve currency has changed. It's a long road before it's a short road. I forget which writer used to say, you know, in describing bankruptcy. How did you go bankrupt? Slowly, then all at once. I think that's the deal for the dollar. It's a slow process. Don't count on it, you know, going up in smoke tomorrow. But when it happens, it'll surprise you how quickly it happens. What you need is a replacement currency. You need something in line with sort of Thomas Kuhn's stories is, as he describes it in the Structure of Scientific Revolutions, if you're going to have a shift in thinking on a particular idea, in this case, the world reserve currency hegemony, you have to have a replacement. What's the replacement idea? What's the replacement currency? Could have been the euro. Not really now. Could it be the RMB? Don't know. Maybe it is. But their capital markets aren't deep enough yet. Their bond markets aren't liquid enough yet for that to be the case. That takes time.
Yeah, it's going to take some time. And we're just about out of time.
I just want to say one thing on the dollar, because it just broke 92, which is a very critical support.
Yes.
It's one of the things that is energizing, I think, an awareness amongst investors that no, gold is not done in this particular cycle. We sat at 92 last week on support, hit 91.7, now 91.28. And this is not a good story. This is not a good story at all if you're talking about the short-term technicals for the U.S. dollar. And that's one of the reasons why I think gold's having a pretty strong move earlier this week.
Yeah, I think you're right. And certainly Michael Oliver, who is on our show almost every other week, says also that 91 is a key area, and he thinks we're going down to 85 on the index, so if we break that. So that would certainly put some wind at the backs of gold. And silver, I suppose you like a little better than gold in terms of its percentage possibilities on the upside. And what about copper with about 30 seconds left?
I do like copper. It's an area of emphasis for us, although getting a pure play is not altogether easy in terms of the quality of companies available. Silver is interesting. Through this whole correction, you've maintained a gold-silver ratio of about 77 to 1, which has been very healthy. Not a lot of deterioration in silver vis-a-vis gold, which has been very healthy. And this last week, even the mining shares only losing what the metals lost was a very good indication of support in the markets. So I would look at silver as having a strong move. We're at 75 to 1 now. Mm-hmm. That'll settle into the 40s. That may be this year, which would be quite an outperformance.
Wow. Boy, that would be great for silver, that's for sure. All right, well, that's it, David. That's all the time we have. Thank you so much for being with us once again. It's always a pleasure hearing your thoughts on the markets and beyond. So we'll look to talk to you again sometime soon, hopefully, and all the best to you and your family and your team there at the McIlvenny Group of Companies.
Thank you, Jay, and thanks for starting with that idea that we're custodians of a bigger general story.
Very important for joy and happiness and success in life, overall success, not just monetary success. Thank you so much. Well, folks, that is it for this week. Next week, Richard Mayberry will be with me, Michael Oliver, and Marco Rock of Cassier Gold Corp. Until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Novo Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.